6 minutes after the hour of 12 noon, Monday, March 21st, 2022, the day after spring equinox. And here's the thing, you know, we try to bring you the news as, you know, we find its relevance. I mean, the most important thing is to, as Bob and I talked about beforehand, is being able to sift through the propaganda and get to the truth. And there is one such source out there that basically does something. I mean, when I think of investigative journalism, I'm talking about stuff like what Project Veritas does. And there's another source which I get a lot of information from, and that's openthebooks.com. If you've never heard of it, you are going to now, because Open the Books does a lot of investigations all over the country of various things, and its publisher, Adam Andrzejewski. This is the first time I've had him on the show since I've been doing this, and it's always a pleasure. They filed 47,000 Freedom of Information Act requests and captured $12 trillion in government spending last year. Harvard Law and Columbia School of Journalism hosted his presentations on big data and forensic auditing. They have been featured on the BBC, Good Morning America, virtually all the mainstream, you know, sources. But the thing is, Forbes got pressured to shut him off because they're speaking the truth. That's one of the reasons when the mainstream media starts to shut you down, we want to talk to you. And so, Adam, welcome to the show.
Well, great to be on the program, Dave. It's great to be here.
Well, and, you know, the thing is we have a lot of truth seekers out there that are just dying to know about this latest report you did investigating Fauci's finances.
Well, National Institutes of Health, they're Fauci's employer. They came down on, they came down hard on Forbes. Forbes came down hard on me. I told the truth, and they pulled the plug. And that's the story. The information that we were exposing on the Fauci family finances was so sensitive that on a Sunday morning, two bureau directors over at NIH, two public affairs officers, two public affairs officers on a Sunday morning took time out from defending the health of the country against the COVID pandemic to write a letter to Forbes, an institution that's been around for 100 years. Essentially saying that we don't like Andrzejewski's, we don't like what Andrzejewski is exposing on Dr. Fauci, and they proved Fauci's protected. You know, and quickly Forbes got the message and canceled my column.
Yeah, that's sad, because people, if they don't get the truth, they're being led like hogs, sheep to the slaughter. These people need to understand that we are at war with our own government, and this is proof of it right here in the pudding. Now, I want to get into Fauci's finances. What really struck you as odd when you started reviewing his finances? Give us I don't want even the 40,000 foot view. I want the down and dirt in the trenches view.
Thing we exposed, and this was 14 months ago in January of 2021, Dr. Fauci was the most highly compensated federal employee, out-earning the president, four-star generals in the United States military, and 4.3 million of his colleagues. And he's the director of a sub-agency at a sub-agency of Health and Human Services. So people rightly ask the question, how can this be? So he made, in 2021, he made $456,000. Top paid. Number two, we found that his wife, Mrs. Fauci, Christine Grady, she out-earns the Vice President of the United States as the chief bioethicist of the National Institutes of Health. So the Faucis live a conflict of interest on bioethics around the breakfast table, at the office, and around the dinner table. Now, Mrs. Fauci makes $238,000. So, Dave, if you take their base federal salaries, you tack on 30% for taxpayer-paid benefits, and the two Faucis every year at taxpayer expense clean off more than $900,000 a year.
That is amazing. And not only that, but, I mean, we're not even talking about their patents and the connection to that. NIH has patents. Fauci has patents. They got patents all over the place. What kind of money do they make off of that?
To Fauci's ethics disclosures. Now we're fast-forwarding into the Senate hearing, Fauci's code red moment. You remember in January, everybody does, when Fauci melted down on national television. He's the top doctor. He melts down in the Senate hearing when U.S. Senator Roger Marshall's questioning him on what our investigation at OpenTheBooks.com had found on the Fauci financials, that he was the top paid, that his financials at that point were not online. They were not public knowledge. But Dr. Fauci, he misled the American people in that hearing. He said that his financials were public knowledge. And then on the open mic, he called the U.S. senator a moron.
I heard that.
So you can't be the nation's top doctor if you're melting down on national television in a Senate hearing. Okay, so our information was used for that hearing, for those questions, and Marshall cited Forbes, which was my column. Marshall followed up on that with a demand letter for the Fauci ethics disclosures. We immediately got that. I gave it oversight, worked through the night, quantified it, put it up at Forbes, and here's what we found, that the two Faucis have a household net worth that rivals $11 million. At the peak of the pandemic, in the year 2020, on a household basis, their income from their federal salaries, their investment gains, their royalties, and other perks was almost $1.8 million in the year. We also found that immediately in February of 2021, Dr. Tony Fauci received a $1 million prize from a foundation in Israel expressly for speaking truth to power during the Trump administration. Dave, that's not his role. And there's actually a federal law from 1913 called the Gillette Amendment that bars the bureaucrat from being the publicity man, from being the propagandist. Okay, so we can circle back on that. These are just some of the findings we exposed in the Forbes column. This triggered the National Institutes of Health. They came down hard on Forbes. They came down hard on me and quickly pulled the plug.
Well, how do they come down hard on you other than to censor you? The thing is, when you're telling the truth and you're exposing this guy violating federal law and nothing happens, there's no consequence. And the reason obviously is because the Democrats now control the House. What do you see in November? You see a shift or no?
Well, I think Dr. Fauci is going to retire, and we've estimated his retirement golden parachute pension payout in his first year to be north of $355,000, the largest in federal history. So he's got a lot of paid time off, we assume, accumulated. He's been there for 55 years. What most people don't realize is that federal benefits are very lucrative. Just in your third year, the average federal bureaucrat receives nearly 9 full weeks of paid time off. It's 44 days. It's an incredible amount of paid time off. So Fauci's probably banked a ton of it. It's probably looking real attractive for him right now. And I assume he'll use up the paid, he'll dig into his paid time off bank account. And then if Republicans do take over the House and have investigative authority in the majority, then he'll quickly retire.
Well, it won't be just quickly retiring. It'll be possibly facing prison time if they get their way. I mean, impeaching somebody is one thing. I mean, if they already quit, it's like what they're trying to do to Trump in this January 6th committee, which is a joke because it's not a real legal committee. It's only got 9 people. It needs 13 according to their own rules. They can't even violate their own rules and then or stick to their own rules. And then they turn around and they sit there and they publicly, through Liz Cheney, another, blowhard, sit there and claim that, we're out to get Trump to make sure he doesn't run again. And it's like, look, they could make Trump a kingmaker instantly through this. The man doesn't need to run again in office. They just need to put people in there that could do the right thing. But the way Congress is spending money like a drunken sailor, I mean, you know this, Adam, because you have been doing this stuff as part of OpenTheBooks.com ever since you guys came into existence.
That's right. We follow the money. We follow it on a nonpartisan basis. We follow these omnibus, minibus, COVID aid bills. We follow even small instances every single day. I've got a column at Real Clear Policy called The Waste of the Day, and we post it at OpenTheBooks.com. We follow all of it and expose all of it. Our former honorary chairman of OpenTheBooks.com was the legendary U.S. Senator Dr. Tom Coburn from Oklahoma, and that's what Coburn did. He You know, he helped open the federal checkbook in 2006, reached across the aisle with Obama to sponsor the legislation that makes our work possible on the Google Your Government Act, which posted the federal checkbook for the first time in history. And then Coburn did his, you know, his waste book, but he couldn't stop in the U.S. Senate. He used the Senate rules to stop thousands of pork barrel expenditure programs. They called him Dr. No. When he couldn't stop, he embarrassed his colleagues in his waste book report every single year. And we follow in those footsteps at OpenTheBooks.com.
Well, that's incredible, too. Now, he obviously, you were talking before we went on the air about the three-minute deal. So where does that play into all this?
So Coburn delivered babies back in his small town in Oklahoma, and he delivered about 3,000 babies. And when he was leaving the U.S. Senate, he issued his warning to America. And there's an analogy back to his days as a doctor when he was delivering babies. He said that sometimes on the law of large numbers, the pregnancy, the delivery would be in trouble. And you knew there was a problem when the baby's heartbeat, which is normally 140 to 150 beats a minute, would fall to 50 or 60 beats a minute. Coburn said, at that moment, as a doctor, you had a decision to make, to save the life of the mother, to save the life of the baby. And he said you had options. You could use the forceps to pull the baby out. You could use the vacuum extractor. You could put the mother up on the table, cut a hole in her belly, and take the baby by C-section. But he said the point was you had 3 minutes to make a decision to save the life of the mother, to save the life of the baby. And he said, here in America, this is our three-minute moment on waste, fraud, corruption, and taxpayer abuse, and our national debt. If we don't take action, we're going to lose the baby.
All right. Now, so you have gotten the 40,000-foot view of where our Congress has gone ever since it was allowed to, like, for example, this is a big bone that a lot of people have to pick about Social Security and the fact that Congress literally has raided it. What have you found out about that?
Well, let's just go right to the latest bipartisan vote on the $1.5 trillion spending bill from last week. So Republicans cheered because there was a 6% increase in defense spending. Democrats cheered because there was a 7% increase in social welfare program spending and the spending in the executive agencies. And so it passed on a bipartisan basis. 2,700 pages dropped 24 hours before the vote. No one had time to read the bill. It sails through the House, goes over to the Senate, passes the Senate. Biden signs it. Presto. It's already the law. The government is already fully funded for the next year. And here's the dirty little secret. There was 4,400 earmarks in that bill. And earmarks are member pet projects. It's the grease that codifies the power of Pelosi and Schumer. And Republican earmarks are in there and Democratic earmarks. So it's like $3 million for a fisherman's co-op in Guam. I mean, it is the currency of corruption in Congress. You know, Coburn, as a United States senator, partnered with Obama to put a 10-year moratorium on those things. But the Republicans a year ago in the House, they took a secret vote and joined Democrats on this horrible concept of earmarking pork barrel projects. And now it's back.
So you publish this stuff on your website and OpenTheBooks.com, the names of all those Republicans that voted for this, because there's a lot of rhinos in office right now, and a lot of them who we didn't think were rhinos are coming to the surface as rhinos now, and it looks like they can be bought, and we have the best Congress money can buy, as far as I'm concerned, in a one-party system.
Well, we exposed the 23 Republican freshmen last summer. So in one of the early drafts of the infrastructure bill, of course, Pelosi puts in earmarks for 23 Republican members of Congress. These were folks that ran as being fiscal conservatives, but in that secret vote, obviously, they backed earmarks. So basically, when you're backing earmarks when you're in the minority, you're codifying the House Speaker's power. That's empowering Pelosi as the House Speaker. So, of course, Pelosi turns around and puts nearly $400 million worth of transportation earmarks in for the 23 freshmen. It took only 5 months for these freshmen that ran as fiscal conservative outsiders to be turned into Pelosi insiders. And we published that article at Forbes.
Oh, and that's another thing that probably irritated a lot of the people that were very much against the transparency in the federal government against you. 844-769-2944. We are on the phone with Adam Andrzejewski from OpenTheBooks.com. Folks, if you have not subscribed to this website, you need to. You need to bookmark it, and you need to go check it on a daily basis, because this work is nonstop. Everything that they do is nonstop. They're looking into every single nook and cranny of public spending. And, I mean, they've literally investigated California. Where are we going on California? What's California done? Have they finally opened their books, or are you still trying to pull hen's teeth out there?
Oh, that's a great question, Dave, and thanks for asking it. So 2 years ago, we sued state comptroller Betty Yee over the lack of disclosure. She had rejected our Freedom of Information Act request for the line-by-line vendor payments in the state of California. She admitted paying 50 million individual bills the previous year. We want a copy of the database that showed exactly where taxpayer money went. We get this in 49 out of 50 states. Back in the day, we had to sue Illinois and Wyoming, Republicans. The last state, the last holdout is California. It was time to sue the Democrat. So we did that. And for 2 years, we were in court. And we thought we had a thoughtful judge. He was very diligent. We thought when he wrote his order, we got nothing, not a single transaction. The judge bought the horrible argument out of the comptroller that it was an undue burden even to produce a single transaction, that the burden to her staff outweighed the public interest in seeing where our taxpayer dollars were being spent. We thought it was just absolutely outrageous. So although we could not file the request, one request with the comptroller and get all the payments, we have filed that request with the 550 state agencies. We've already captured $65 billion worth of line-by-line spending, about 4.5 million vendor payments already. And so we're very serious about breaking open the California spending, and it looks like we're going to be successful in our quest.
Wow, that's just phenomenal. And, I mean, the thing is that this was a federal judge that did that. Was that judge an Obama appointee?
So that was a California Superior Court judge.
Oh, a Superior Court judge.
Based in Sacramento,
okay.
California. Right, so that was a state case, a state judge, and he bought their horrible argument, hook, line, and sinker, which raises the question, if our elected representatives get to claim that they can withhold all taxpayer spending from the taxpayers and claim it's for our own good, do we really have a representative republic?
Makes sense to me. Sherry in Kansas, you're on the phone with Adam Andrzejewski. What's your question?
Yes. Say that the government turns over at the next, at least the House and Senate turns over at the next election, and Fauci does decide to retire. Can they still go after him for malfeasance in office if they can find grounds? Like, that's going to be hard?
Well, it's always a high bar. It is always a high bar, and it would not be easy. Dr. Fauci's very smart, understands all the levers, you know, within his agency. He's been there since dirt, and you can already see how this plays out in the Senate hearings, for example, with Senator Rand Paul. So although NIH admits to funding gain-of-function at the Wuhan facility, Fauci's able to say that he didn't fund gain-of-function at the Wuhan facility, and it just comes down to the definition of words. And so it's very, very, the very high bar. It's very difficult to do. In terms of gain-of-function, everybody should read the 30-page study from August of 2021 called Science in the Shadows, done by the Washington Post. It's an extraordinary investigation that determined that through the director of the National Institutes of Health, Francis Collins, and Dr. Fauci, they actually, between 2012 and 2018, the pair of them circumvented the pause on gain-of-function experiments instituted first by Obama, carried forward by Trump 18 times, and spent $44 million funding these highly risky experiments. And that's the Washington Post.
That's just the Post.
Well, yeah, you know,
right.
He
so
did.
If they say it, it's got to be the truth.
You know, he did at one time say approve of ivermectin in years past for exactly what they were using it for this so-called COVID. And Dave, you said in your first hour something about the death penalty and Fauci. I think we should put him on remdesivir.
What a great punishment that would be, wouldn't it, Aunt Adam?
Yeah, organ failure.
All right, there
thanks.
You go. Thank you, Sherry. Appreciate your call.
We called on National Institutes of Health to come clean on everything related to COVID, in specific to remdesivir. Mrs. Fauci, Christine Grady, she's chief of the bioethics. She has 30 bioethicists churning out reports on everything related to COVID. She gave an interview and said millions and millions of angles they're studying related to ethics and the COVID response of our country. She gave that interview in the summer of 2020 to Elle magazine. All of those studies need to be released. She's admitted to studying the ethical implications of delivery of remdesivir. That report should obviously see the light of day. We're calling on NIH to release all of her ethics reports. It is a massive conflict of interest to have Mrs. Fauci, Christine Grady, running point on the nation's ethical response to COVID-19, and her husband, Tony Fauci, running point on the nation's response to COVID-19.
Well, that is, you know, that's like the pot calling the kettle black in this instance. Adam, this is crazy. OpenTheBooks.com is the website. Folks, if you have not subscribed to this, and I get this, I am registered to get this, I read it constantly to see what's going on. You can even support it, too, because a lot of the stuff they do needs your support, and we appreciate that. Adam Andrzejewski, thanks so much for being with us on the Power Hour. We're going to have you back again. I know you're going to have more stuff for us, so we'll have you back. And we appreciate that. We're going to have Benjamin Barton on the phone here with us. The credentialed court inside the cloistered elite world of American justice. Oh, how corrupt it is. After we get back from our break, Dave Krieger on the Power Hour. Stay with us.
We've all heard about antibiotics, but what about probiotics? Antibiotic means against life. Probiotic means pro-life. Antibiotics kill bacteria that are infectious and harmful to the body. They also kill the good bacteria, though, that are necessary for good health. Probiotics from Living Streams replaces the healthy balance of friendly bacteria and normalizes the digestive tract. Gastritis, ulcers, diarrheal disease is just a few of the problems people develop when the intestinal flora is out of balance. Living Streams probiotics create the healthy balance needed for good digestion, suppresses growth of pathogenic bacteria, and actually increases resistance to infection. Call the Power Hour, 877-817-9829. Order your Living Stream probiatics today. They're available in 2, 4, and 8-ounce bottles, and Living Streams probiotics comes with a money-back guarantee. Get your body back in balance with Living Streams probiotics today. 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Living Streams probiotics. Everyone should be pro-life.
Boost your immune system naturally this year with Olive Oregano, a potent germ killer. This is the true wild oregano oil P73, a blend of edible spices of wild oregano grown on natural mineral-rich soils. Research published in the International Journal of Food Microbiology found that olive oregano is an excellent germicide capable of killing a wide range of fungi and bacteria. Get it today by visiting thepowermall.com or calling 877-817-9829.
The Power Hour has been in existence since the turn of the 21st century. It is more critical than ever for you to sign up for our free newsletter and our breaking news. Simply text the word Power Hour to 22828 on your mobile phone or sign up when you visit thepowerhour.com. Our website again is thepowerhour.com or text Power Hour to 22828. Together, our legacy will live on for centuries.
Hi, this is Jay at the Power Mall. When talking of great immune support, a line of products comes to my mind. That's North American Urban Spice. We carry the Rest Vital Caps, Sinew Orega, Oreganol Juice, Purely C, Chaga Max, Collagen Power Plus, Orega Rest, Super Strength Oregano Oil, Black Seed, and many more. Support small businesses when you buy from the good guys. Go to thepowermall.com or call 877-817-9829.
I don't know where to start. There's so many products you guys offer. I think one of the first things I ever ordered from you guys was your clay. The clay is miraculous. I could not do without that. And the charcoal, you know, you can get yourself in a bathtub to kind of help take the toxins out. So just those two alone, but I could go on to the Optivita silver lozenges. Of course, then the Oregaresp and the P73, the oil of oregano, and your Vitamir toothpaste. Again, I could go on and on and on.
Call Jay at thepowermall.com and receive superior customer service. Call 1-877-817-9829 right now. That number again is 1-877-817-9829. Support small businesses and buy from the good guys at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com.
This craft that the Strokes family had of recognizing the medicinal value of herbs by taste and then putting formulas together, knowing the herbal ingredients they needed, but putting them together in perfect proportion by taste, just like a chef would, the Strokes Heart Drops, the world-famous Strokes Heart Drops that saved my life, Jim Strokes's and many others, my dad, my list goes on. But those Heart Drops, they were developed, created 40 years ago for Jim himself after a heart attack. Now, this formula fixed my high blood pressure over 20 years ago, and I have had great blood pressure since.
Call Jay at 877-817-9829 right now. That number again is 1-877-817-9829. Support small businesses and buy from the good guys at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com.
Two minutes after the hour of 12 noon, Monday, Central Time, March 21st, the day after spring equinox. Dave Krieger with you on the Power Hour. Thank you so much for joining us. And, of course, you know, we have delved into the subject of the foreclosure business. I started in 2007 when I noticed mortgage electronic registration systems popping up into people's land records and scratched my head thinking, what is going on here? Over time, I learned just how weird and corrupt the justice system could actually become. In fact, it could be some so politicized. It's crazy. I mean, starting with what they learn in law schools to what judges were saying on the bench during foreclosure hearings. Well, I'm sorry, but whether, you know, you have all your paperwork in order, Mr. Homeowner's Foreclosure Defense Attorney, but the problem is we can't hurt the banks. Even though the banks came to court and they were flat out lying, and we proved it in various reports I did throughout the United States. Well, we have an attorney with us that's a distinguished professor of law at the University of Tennessee. He is the Helen and Charles Lockett Distinguished Professor of Law, University of Tennessee. I want to get that right. And this is Professor Ben Barton, who has authored four books, Fixing Law Schools, Rebooting Justice, Glass Half Full, The Decline and Rebirth of the Legal Profession. I just got to, you know, scratch my head, you know, the lawyer judge bias in American courts. And in Connecticut, I've just learned that the judges in that state can literally write on the spot, disbar an attorney for malpractice in open court. I was just shocked to even learn that fact. And so we are, I just have this real sneaking suspicion about the politicization of the justice system in America, which is why we have Benjamin Barton on. He is a professor. He has a new book out called The Credentialed Court, Inside the Cloistered Elite World of American Justice. Benjamin H. Barton, welcome to the Power Hour, sir. Thank you so much for coming on.
Absolutely my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And now, so the thing is, if you could, and I always ask this of most of the people that have books out, about the 40,000-foot view of where we are inside this cloistered elite world of American justice, because I'm looking at it, it's not pretty. What's your take?
Yeah, perfect take on it. Yeah, so the book starts with the study of what Supreme Court justices in America did before they joined the court, basically what their life experiences were before they became Supreme Court justices. And I start with the first one, John Jay, and I studied all the way up to Amy Coney Barrett. And then I put it all together And I looked at it and I said, have these things changed over time? And the short answer is they've changed a lot. And they've changed to what I call this cloistered elite model of Supreme Court justice. So if Judge Jackson joins the court, you'll have 7 of 9 justices who graduated from an Ivy League university. If Judge Jackson joins the court, 8 of 9 of them will have gone to either Harvard or Yale Law School. If she joins the court, 6 of them will have been former Supreme Court clerks. And that's the hardest job in America to get out of law school. 3 of them will have replaced the justice that they clerked for, which is especially sort of backwards and inbred if you think about it. And then a bunch of them, they will mostly have lived in D.C. They'll mostly have worked at big law firms in D.C. or for fancy government jobs. These are not folks, I mean, 8 of 9 of them will have been a federal court of appeals judge. And that's a job where you never meet a regular person. You never leave your chambers. And so these are folks who have lived very narrow lives, basically since they were 18. And worse yet, they all have lived the same life. It's crazy to think about it, but Alito and Sotomayor, a liberal justice and a conservative justice, both Princeton grads, both Yale law grads, both former prosecutors, both of them having worked in similar places in their legal careers. It's hard to pick 2 people who have lived more similar lives than those 2, and they find themselves together on the court.
That is some scary information you just shared. 844-769-2944 is the number to call. I know there's a lot of you out there that don't trust the justice system. I'm seeing January 6th at Royce Lamberth and other judges in the D.C. Circuit just going crazy on these people and literally treating them like political prisoners. This is something I maybe just, it's not just the world of foreclosure where I see these state judges going and beating up on homeowners, calling them a bunch of deadbeats because they've been ripped off by their bank or some servicer has screwed them over on their escrow accounts and won't answer for it. And the judges are literally covering for them. And now we're going all the way to the top. And it's amazing that there is somebody out there, folks, that has taken and looked at the Supreme Court for what it is. Now, there are some justices I've read, Ben Barton, that they're literally, when you look at like Learned Hand, Brandeis, some of these people, I mean, these were really smart people. These were really great thinkers. They had good minds. What's changed?
Yeah, well, Brandeis is a tremendous example of that. Brandeis, the only thing, he did go to Harvard Law School, but then he just worked as a lawyer. And when he was put on the court, his basic qualification was he was the best lawyer in America. We haven't had a person who joined the court with that qualification for decades. Instead, you have, and basically, he proved his mettle the old-fashioned way. He opened up a business and was super, super successful at it. And that was a really typical person to put on the court in the past. We used to have former politicians. The last former politician who made it on the court was Sandra Day O'Connor. Roughly a third of the justices on the Supreme Court had at least some experience knocking on doors and trying to get votes. And I'm not saying everybody in the court should have been a former politician, but that's an easy way to figure out how the government works, number one, give you some respect for the legislature and how the legislature works, number two. And number three, an easy way to get you out in front of regular, ordinary people, you know? Like if you've worked as a law professor or you've worked as a federal court of appeals judge, you just never see anybody except other lawyers.
No doubt. And the thing is, on the appellate circuit, I mean, this is the thing. For the first 100 years of the court, according to my show notes, the justices heard cases all over the country on circuit. And so these are the things I don't know as far as the history of law and where it came from back in the days that the pontiffs used to travel the circuit, which is where circuit courts came from. And they would hear various arguments between parties and then rule on them. And so this is very similar as to what happened. And now, of course, now I didn't go to law school, but let me tell you, you would be surprised at the size of my law library, professor.
Yep. No. And that would be typical. There's more than 10 former Supreme Court justices were completely self-educated. They either read the law or just taught it to themselves along the way. And so, again, you can't get any more different from that than everybody going to Harvard or Yale. We used to have a court, and honestly, we used to have a country where there are a lot of routes to proving yourself, where we've always had a meritocracy, but there used to be more than just one route to it. Now it's just the same series of never-ending, narrowing hoops, and it's just a shame. You would just like to see more diversity of experience on the court, for sure.
Oh, and
the circuit riding thing is... The circuit riding thing is super funny. Yeah, so for the first 100 years, a big chunk of the justice's job is they used to go out in the country and they would hear trials. They would hear intermediate appeals. The first Supreme Court, they had six justices and three circuits. And so you had two justices who would ride what they called the Southern Circuit. And needless to say, they did not enjoy this very much because the roads weren't very good. And there's all these crazy stories. I mean, there's justices where a bridge gets washed out from a flood while they're on it in their carriage. There's a story of sleeping in a rascally public house where they get assaulted at night while they're sleeping. So it's the justices never enjoyed it. But again, the reason they did this, the founders did this, they did it on purpose, is they wanted the Supreme Court out amongst the people. The last thing they wanted was a bunch of people who were cloistered in D.C. and never saw any regular folks. They had the wisdom in the first 100 years to actually get people out on the road.
And, you know, the first time, I mean, the only time that I ever see these justices is when there's a joint session of Congress. And you know, I mean, now we have one justice who's now in the hospital. And 844-769-2944. Folks, if you got questions about the court, you have somebody here that's very learned and understands what's going on. Amy Coney Barrett, Professor Barton, this is something I really liked her when I first saw her. She has probably more of a poker face than most judges. Very unpredictable. Yep. I liked it when she was writing for the Seventh Circuit. I thought she was great, and I really thought she's going to be a moderate on this court. Has anything changed as far as your feelings of where she was and where she is now?
I put it at too soon to tell. She does add some nice changes to the court. So she didn't go to an Ivy League undergrad. She went to Rhodes College in beautiful Memphis, Tennessee. In fact, humorously, she's the second justice to have gone to Rhodes College. And so that's more justices than Vanderbilt or Duke or Emory. So I just go ahead and call Rhodes College the Harvard of the South. I think they've got the actual claim to it.
That's interesting.
She went to Notre Dame Law School, so that's a different situation as well. That being said, she finished first in her class in Notre Dame and then clerked for Scalia, and then she was a law professor. So basically from law school forward, she actually looks pretty similar to a lot of these other folks.
Interesting. Now, Scalia, that's a whole nother thing. Antonin Scalia, your take on him. How did he play into this court? I mean, obviously, I look at Scalia and I look at the current, you know, situation with the Chief Justice there. How do they compare?
Yeah, so Scalia was a former law professor, and there was a chunk of time where they had Scalia, and they had Breyer, and they had Kagan, and they had Ginsburg. And so, again, the issue with the fact that everybody's got the same credentials is bipartisan. And so you had a lot of former law professors. At one point, you had five former law professors on a nine-person court. And so at that point, you're just turning the court committee meetings into faculty meetings. And I can tell you, having attended faculty meetings, that's not good. Bad thing, for sure. And Scalia was an admirable person, is a great writer. But I thought that he and some was similar to other former law professors in that I felt sometimes he was trying to prove to us that he was smarter than us, more than that he was trying to answer the question directly and move on, if that makes sense.
Sure. Well, and the thing is I'm looking at what Chief Judge Roberts did, you know, screaming at the court. Do you remember that little instance right after January 6th about moving forward, moving on, and ignoring things? I always know that the Supreme Court has ruled narrowly, but, you know, some of the stuff that he did, you know, in badgering the rest of the justices at that point, I was really concerned that, you know, things were turning left, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think Roberts has had a hard time gathering these folks, and I don't know whether it's hard to know how to answer that. Here's what I'll say about that. We have on the court now, if you think that going to an Ivy League college and then clerking on the Supreme Court and being a very super hyper technical lawyer is a great qualification, then we've got the most qualified court we've ever had. But having everybody have this same route onto the court, in my opinion, just means that they all have the same skill set, and that's not helpful. It's like having a basketball team where you've got five guys who all want to shoot. This Supreme Court is just packed with people who want to demonstrate to each other how smart they are. And that's why you get so many concurrences. That's why you get so many dissents. I think that's at least part of the reason why Roberts has a hard time getting these folks on the same page. When what you want to do is to demonstrate to everybody that you're the best at being a technical legal writer and a technical legal arguer, it's just going to be hard to get people on the same page.
Right. So the current court, according to my notes here, is the most diverse in history in terms of race and gender, but lacks diversity across other dimensions. What are those?
Totally. So educational diversity is a perfect example of it. Geographic diversity is a perfect example of it. This current group of justices has spent more time living in Washington, D.C. than any Supreme Court from the first to the last before they got onto the court. And if you think about it for a second, the career path that these folks have taken, that's where the fanciest jobs are. They're working at big corporate law firms in D.C., or they're working at the White House, or they're working in the Solicitor General's office. It's all of these sort of hyper-elite things. You know, so, for example, if you're the former president from Ohio who has been on the Supreme Court, or you're a former senator from South Carolina, you spent a lot of time in South Carolina. You spent a lot of time in Ohio. You spent a lot of time out in the country, you know, gathering votes and doing that work. And with this career path, you just spend a lot of time in D.C. And it's not just the time in D.C. It's like from the time that you're 18 forward, that, you know, you step in the doors of an Ivy League undergrad, your peer group is just a very, very, very specific group of people. And it's hard to branch out from that.
Well, and it seems to me like it's all liberal. I mean, because it is a liberal education. This is a problem as far as, you know, what you say in your book, The Decline and Rebirth of the Legal Profession. I mean, now they're basically allowing different kinds of tests to creep in besides LSAT. And the ABA itself looks like it's becoming more liberal, because I subscribe to and get every week the ABA Journal. And I'm reading these articles, yeah, and I'm going, wow, where are these people going with this stuff? What's your take on that?
I think that's super fair. I think that's fair. I mean, but again, I just want to note, for me, the background thing is a bipartisan thing. Justice Kavanaugh and Gorsuch have almost identical backgrounds to the last Obama guy, Merrick Garland. If you lay on the table the things that all three of those guys did since they were 18, they're identical. They're the same. They went to Ivy League undergrad. They went to Ivy League law school. They clerked on the Supreme Court. They worked in D.C. To a certain extent, I mean, it is true that if you do those things, you tend to run into more liberal people. But the bigger issue is that everyone's agreeing on it. Like, it was like when Trump was elected, it was unclear, at least until he gave the list of people he was going to appoint, what he was going to do. Here's a guy who was elected running against elites. I mean, I saw him speak a lot of times, and every time he stood up there, he just railed and railed and railed against elites and the job they've done of running this country. And so when he was elected, I was like, who knows? Maybe he'll mix it up. Maybe we'll get somebody unusual on the court. But that's how bipartisan the agreement is on this, on the backgrounds of Supreme Court justices, that the Trump justices, in terms of life experience, look identical to the Obama justices. And this is a weird thing to say, but Judge Jackson, except for the public defender part, looks identical to everybody else on the court as well. I mean, it's a Democrat, Republican, it's the elite versus non-elite thing, not Democrat versus Republican thing, if that makes sense.
Well, sure it does. And the thing that gets me the most about the court is the fact the Biden administration wants to pack it and have more than the current amount of justices on there. From a legal perspective, I mean, obviously, did that play into what you were putting in print when you wrote this book?
Yeah, so I kind of left that to the side because I wanted to describe what I thought was a problem and then choose solutions that were sort of neutral in the following way. The court packing. So, I mean, the court has had as sat with quorum with as few as five people. The original Supreme Court had six justices on it. It's had as many as 10. Now, all of that happened in the 18th and 19th century. But it has bounced around in the numbers. And, I mean, the Congress has plenary power over that. I mean, Congress can make it bigger. Congress can make it smaller. The reason it stayed at 9 for a long time is because of tradition, not because Congress isn't allowed to do it. That being said, the people who want to pack the court, I do not think they want to pack the court because they're like, you know, 15 is a better number than 9. It would work better. It's obvious to me that they want to pack the court to change the balance of what's on the court. And so I don't find that a very persuasive reason for any changes. If they want to change the court so that it is more reflective of geographic diversity, that would thrill me. If they want to change the court so that the justices get out and see more regular people and bring some more practical wisdom when they get on the bench, then I would be thrilled with that as well.
No doubt. No, this is from a college perspective. You're basically looking at this Supreme Court as a club of sorts of educated. And the thing is that, and just one of the things that I've noticed in the way that cases are, and I'm talking about like the Twombly, Bell Atlantic versus Twombly, Ashcroft versus Iqbal. The Obdusky case, the Spokio case. I'm looking at all these cases and just wigging out over the fact that it's the narrow ruling, but it's the way that they came at this. It scared the hell out of me. I mean, is this what we can expect from our future justice system?
Oh, for sure. And dude, one of the I talk about Twombly and Iqbal in the book as an example. The Supreme Court used to have a lot of former lawyers on it. And by former lawyers, I don't mean people who went to law school and then worked in D.C. for the White House. I mean people who appeared in court and tried cases and made a living practicing law. Supreme Court used to have a lot of people who were district court judges. Now, if you want to learn about what trials look like in America, it's probably a good idea to start a district court, not in a federal court of appeals where you never see any of that. So what's an actual ramification of that? What do you see in that? The Supreme Court, over the last decades, has had a healthy disrespect for trials. They've had a disrespect for juries. They've had a disrespect for civil procedure that leads to trials with juries. If you are an originalist and you care about the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, you should be appalled by that. Appalled. The founders thought that the jury right was the single most important hedge against government overreach. It was literally Jefferson's favorite constitutional right and then part of the Bill of Rights.
Well, see, Twombly and Iqbal to me was all about procedure, was all about civil procedure and how far you could take a case, what you had to prove, what you had to show in order for them to even grant you the time to be in their forum.
Yep.
I mean, this is what, you know, I just saw the tide turning and I'm going, wow, based on Twombly, Iqbal, and now Spokio, well, you have to have suffered a concrete injury in fact in order for us to declare that you have standing to proceed. I mean, I'm looking at this stuff going, my God, you know, and there's so many cases out now in the circuits where there's a conflict in the circuits. And are they really that anal, the Supreme Court, that they are picking and choosing which ones they want to do because it's basically politically convenient for them?
Right. Well, also note that civil procedure aspects of those cases, it's not just that it's harder to plead. It's that the judge gets to make the call. The judge is the one who gets rid of the case. The judge reads the stuff and decides whether you've said enough and can get to survive and move on. And all of that takes power away from juries. I mean, the original way it was supposed to work was you filed, they brought in a jury of your peers, they decided. And they decided in criminal cases and in civil cases. And so when you switch it up and make it so that judges are doing all the deciding at the front end, that's all taking power away from the jury and taking power away from the ordinary people.
And that's one of the things I notice, and people don't read this, when they sign these mortgage documents, they do not read the waiver, usually in paragraph 25 or 26 of the mortgage document or the deed of trust document, about waiving the right to a trial by jury, because it goes right to the bench and to one of these judges that you're talking about right now. This, to me, Professor Barton, is one of the reasons why the corruption in the system starts at the district and circuit court levels and just works its way up to whoever finds it convenient to get appointed to the nation's highest court. I mean, am I distorted in my thinking here?
No, I think that's super fair. And the thing that I'll note is part of the protection of having a jury is that they're not a repeat player. They're one-time players. They come in, they hear the case, they make their call, they go home. it's really, really, really hard to get those people to have a bias one way or another. So, for example, I think it's unlike most judges are not paid off by mortgage companies. That's at least my take on it. What actually happens is if you're a judge who sits in one of these courts, you hear dozens, maybe hundreds of these foreclosure cases in a week, and you just get used to them. You treat them as if they're rote. So when someone comes in and says, wait, no, this one's wrong, you're like, oh, no, it's the same as the other ones, same as the other ones. You know what I mean? Like, you've seen nothing but these cases. You have a strong bias in terms of a certain way of handling it. And again, if a jury heard each one of these cases, they wouldn't bring any bias to it. They don't hear foreclosure cases all week. They work in a bakery. You know, they do something else. So they come in, you have to prove it to them each time. And that's a significant hedge on overreach for these sorts of repeat cases. Like judges who hear cases all the time, and this is true for judges in criminal court, this is true for judges in divorce court, child support court, they can really, really, really get a strong bias on these cases just because they hear them all the time. It's only human nature.
That's true. And of course, you know, then it's like crazy, crazy nonsense to even think that you are going to get your case in front of the Supreme Court of the United States, because they only take a certain amount of court cases every year based on how they pick and choose everything. And I can't wait to read this book, The Credentialed Court: Inside the Cloistered Elite World of American Justice, by Professor Benjamin H. Barton. This probably, Professor, goes right along with my thought process about the current system of the way that our justice system functions in this country. And it isn't pretty. We thank you so much for being on the show. We're going to obviously look into that book, folks. Dave Krieger with you on the Power Hour. It has been a refreshing 2 hours here on Monday, the day after spring equinox. We will join you again tomorrow. Until then, God bless you and God bless the United States of America.
We've all heard about antibiotics, but what about probiotics? Antibiotic means against life. Probiotic means pro-life. Antibiotics kill bacteria that are infectious and harmful to the body. They also kill the good bacteria, though, that are necessary for good health. Probiotics from Living Streams replaces the healthy balance of friendly bacteria and normalizes the digestive tract. Gastritis, ulcers, diarrheal disease is just a few of the problems people develop when the intestinal flora is out of balance. Living Streams probiotics create the healthy balance needed for good digestion, suppresses growth of pathogenic bacteria, and actually increases resistance to infection. Call the Power Hour, 877-817-9829. Order your Living Stream probiotics today. They're available in 2, 4, and 8-ounce bottles, and Living Streams probiotics comes with a money-back guarantee. Get your body back in balance with Living Streams probiotics today. 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Living Streams probiotics. Everyone should be pro-life.
As you all know, everything begins with an idea. Ideas have helped shape the very world we live in. ThePowerMall.com began as an idea, allowing entrepreneurs and small business owners like yourself the opportunity to not only survive, but thrive in an era where corporations dominate. ThePowerMall.com is a small family-owned business who has partnered with companies you've come to rely on and trust over the years, like North American Urban Spice, Miracle 2 Soaps, Vitamir, Numana Food Storage, to name just a few. Fight back against large corporations when you buy from thepowermall.com. Need to speak to a real person? Call Jay at thepowermall.com and receive superior customer service. Call 1-877-817-9829 right now. That number again is 1-877-817-9829. Support small businesses and buy from the good guys at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com.